halls, sample some tunes, and get a taste of the hometown scene. That's Local Produce, Thursdays at 1, Fridays at 9, right here on listener-supported public radio for Acadiana, KRVS.
Tune in every Saturday night at midnight for The Diamond Sea, a weekly mixtape featuring the best in independent music from the 80s, 90s, and today. Here at 88.7 KRVS, public radio for Acadiana.
This is KRVS, 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles.
Good afternoon. It's 3 p.m. Weather for the KRVS listening area. Showers and thunderstorms likely this afternoon and this evening. Mostly cloudy with a high of around, the upper 80s. South wind at 5 miles per hour, a 60% chance of precipitation this afternoon and this evening. Also this evening, a low of about 69 degrees. West winds at 5 miles per hour. On Wednesday, the showers and thunderstorms likely once again, a 60% chance of precipitation continuing through the day on Wednesday. Currently, it's partly cloudy and 87 here on the campus of UL Lafayette. Judith Merriweather will join us in just a few minutes, and at 4 o'clock we have All Things Considered from NPR News. Music begins this hour with the New York Philharmonic under the direction of Leonard Bernstein. This is a performance of the symphonic dances from the score to the film West Side Story.
Thank you. Thank you.
Leonard Bernstein conducting the New York Philharmonic in a performance of a suite of symphonic dances from the film and play West Side Story. You're listening to KRVS 88.7 FM, Lafayette, Lake Charles. Thank you.
Joining me in the KRVS studios this afternoon is John Green, Professor John Green. John, I know many of our listeners know you as the host of Night Train Jazz with that lovely voice you have, and so many of us listen every Tuesday evening from 8 to 10 to this gorgeous program of jazz. But many of our listeners do not know that you are a professor of English here at UL Lafayette, have been for the past 24 years since 1988, and we invited you to come on the radio today to talk about a publication that just happened. Your latest work was published by Lehigh University Press recently, and it's not just any publication. It's 8 volumes of research that you have been working on for the past 30 years?
Roughly 30 years, yeah. I didn't work on it full time the entire 30 years.
You've been doing Night Train Jazz for us.
I wrote a couple of other books in between that. But yes, actually, it's 2 books. I'm just to make that point. There's history, which is 2 volumes, mm-hmm. and there's a calendar of performances, which is 6 volumes. It's called Theater in Dublin. 1745 to 1820.
And still 8 volumes.
Well, it's a lot of words.
Theater in Dublin, 1745 to 1820. Your specialty is 18th century literature. Have you been interested in that since you first started studying literature? Was 18th century always a passion of yours?
No.
Most
people come to the understanding that taste for the 18th century is a lot like a taste for good scotch. It's very much an acquired taste.
But what a taste.
it's one of the most interesting areas that there is, but you have to give it a chance. Mm-hmm. I didn't get interested in it until I was well along in grad school, and I got a job. I think I was working 4 part-time jobs at the time, and as a research assistant to a man by the name of Philip Heifel, who wrote with 2 other men a monumental work of scholarship called A Biographical Dictionary of Actors, Actresses, and All Other Stage Personnel in London, 1660 to 1800. So there I was typing these little biographies and doing, tiny little tasks. And I just became more and more interested in it. And one day Heifel said to me, oh, by the way, there's this manuscript floating around out there that I was asked to review years ago, and it didn't ever get published and all that. Would you be interested in having a look at it? Maybe this would be the sort of thing that you'd be interested in. And it took off from there.
One little question.
Well, yeah. And then, I think it probably, he was a surrogate father figure. I was probably trying to impress him. Mm-hmm. Anyway, unfortunately, he's now so old, I don't think he'd even realize. I haven't heard from him. I did tell him that the book was out. But
I'm sure he's heard about it.
He's one of these. No, yeah. He knows. He knows what it's all about. His book came out in 14 volumes or 16, I can't remember which, but when he was being interviewed about this, and the way the interviewer began was, just one question I'd like to ask you, and says, are you mad? And because 30 years had nothing on, and there were 3 of them, and they put in, I think, 155 years.
Between
the 3 of them.
Well, John, one of the most fascinating things about being around a university campus, working on a university campus, is discovering all the various passions of the people here who teach in so many departments. Many people who are outside of the university hear about departments, biology, English, math, and never really get to look into what everybody is studying, what everyone is doing research on, what you're publishing on. Years ago, I know we had like the foremost international scholar on the salamander, a very particular kind of salamander. And currently, there's someone who's the international scholar on red algae here at the university. Very specific passions, which tell us all so much, even though we may not be aware of it in our daily lives. It informs so many things. And I think people would be very interested to know about the different passions in the English department. Tell us just a bit about why before we delve into your book on theater in Dublin, what is it about the 18th century that is so interesting?
Well, I think one reason is it's not the 19th century. When you had your Victorians and that sort of stereotype, I suppose, of the Victorian prudishness and so forth. The 18th century was a very, in a sense, laissez-faire sort of an era when there wasn't such thing as mass communications yet. And people were themselves, it seems to me, a lot more than they were in have become in later generations. And the coterie audience that you found in the 16th and 17th century for Shakespeare and so on, were, you know, the people from the court transferred their poetry among their friends and so forth. There wasn't sort of mass sales of poetry and so forth. In the 18th century, this began to come into existence. It's just the characters, some of the extraordinary people who lived during that period and the things that they did, and that it's a never-ending source of fascination. And since it is rather distant in time, we have to dig and dig and dig frequently to find out anything about them. And it's a huge detective story, really.
I was just thinking
and
that.
That's what it's all about. I mean, to me, that is the fascination of doing literary research in that period. Mm-hmm. It's a bit. I think if I hadn't become a literary
detective, you would
detective. I maybe have tried another. The police. Although
John
I'm sure
Green,
every policeman is cringing who may be listening.
Well, I think that's actually been the source of some literary novels. Literary detectives.
Sure.
If people are just tuning in right now, my guest is Professor John Green, also host of Night Train Jazz here on KRVS. He is a professor of English at UL Lafayette and is here talking about his latest publication. It's called, there's 8 volumes of it. The first 2 are Theater in Dublin, A History, Volumes 1 and 2, and then A Calendar of Performances, Volumes 1 through 6. And we are talking about the years 1745 to 1820. Now, tell us about that detective work. Why that time period?
Well, the main reason was it hasn't been done. When I was looking for a dissertation topic, one of the things when I was discussing with my friend Heifel various topics, I wanted to work on. I went to school in Ireland. I did my undergraduate work in Ireland, and I loved the place, and I wanted to do something Irish. And every time I would, and particularly in the drama, every time I found something, one of the problems was that the nuts and bolts information simply wasn't there about what happened to these individuals in Ireland. There may be a lot of material about what their careers in London in 1660 to 1800. There's a great work that came out in the 1960s called The London Stage. And The London Stage did for London what I tried to do here for Dublin. And it's to some extent what I've done is modeled on that. Mm-hmm. So there was a lot of material on London, almost nothing on Dublin. And I thought, well, if the study of drama in the 18th century in early 19th century in Ireland is to ever take off at all, this kind of information has to be made available. Mm-hmm. And so that's why I began this task. It expanded like some sort of foam.
The trouble with tribbles. Now we have
red
to say
algae.
That's right. We have to say that you actually published a volume earlier. You actually won a prize for it with Lehigh University.
That's correct. Yes.
And that was
it's called Dublin Stage, 1720 to 1745.
So leading up to this time
but
period.
That's a teensy-weensy little thing. It was the resources simply weren't there. In writing these, what I did was I tried to find every scrap of information that exists in every newspaper that was published during the era, in every memoir, every scrap of information of whatever type, in mm-hmm. every library, well, I shouldn't say in the world, because there wasn't much point in going to New Delhi, although I did look at the card catalog, And just to find if there were anything.
Some mention of an Irish actor or something.
I've gone to 20, 25 libraries over the years. I got a Fulbright, and I was able to spend the best part of a full year in the National Library of Ireland, and they gave me special permission to look at their newspaper collections, which were not available to the public because, frankly, they're falling apart.
Right.
And so that's what I did. And now the thing about the first book is that there just wasn't much material there. There weren't the newspapers.
From 1720 to 1745.
Yes.
So what happened? Tell us about this time period, the 1745 to 1820. What was going on in Dublin and Ireland? I think most of us don't even know there was much theatrical activity.
Mm-hmm.
What was happening? Why was this a special period?
Well, the most important thing to remember is that in this period, Dublin was the second city of the British Empire, if you will. Better to say the British Isles, because mm-hmm. during most of this time, Ireland was not a part of the United Kingdom. That didn't happen until 1800. So you had a large... there were two official theaters in London that were allowed to stay in business, what we call legitimate theaters. And in Dublin, they didn't have the same laws. So they had one Theater Royal, which was presented the kind of the popular plays and so on. And then the Lord Mayor used to have a theater as well. But the point is that many, in fact, I think I say in the history that I only found a very small handful of minor actors who didn't spend some significant part of their careers in Dublin. And so the quality of the performances, the quality of the actors, the quality of the presentations, the theaters themselves, and so forth, were second, I mean, only to London. And sometimes critics said, sometimes they were even better. So it was, in a sense, another very important city.
But not as regulated in the same way.
Well, not really, not officially mm-hmm. regulated. Unofficially, of course, there was always the pressure from the government not to step out of line, because if they did, which they never did, they could get themselves into trouble. And if you happened to be the theater manager of the day and had huge amounts of money invested in running a theater, and you were making relatively huge amounts of money as a result of that, you were not going to take any chances with your livelihood.
Well, give us a sense of who some of the playwrights were. Would these be playwrights that people might have encountered in anthologies, say in high school, college?
Well, yeah, a lot of them would have been. There are always the big ones, and a lot of these fellows happen to be of Irish birth. William Congreve, George Farquhar, there are a lot of Oliver Goldsmith, R.B. Sheridan, and a lot of the sort of secondary lineup of playwrights during this time, Arthur Murphy, John O'Keefe, and so forth and so on. Well, you don't hear them all the time outside of specialist circles anymore. Isaac Bickerstaff was probably the most popular playwright of his day, even though most people have never heard of him. There was a huge number of Irish playwrights writing, but there's a combination of things going on. One thing, that the London theater managers wanted first refusal of any play that they put on, for monetary reasons. I mean, they didn't want used goods, right? So a playwright, if he thought he had a good play and it would sell, didn't present it first to a Dublin manager. He'd go to London and see if he could get it taken on by one of the big theaters royal there. And if he did, if he was successful, he could make a lot of money. And indeed, it was really frowned upon. Most playwrights wouldn't even think about putting it on in Dublin first. But as soon as it was successful in London, of course, the Dublin theater managers jumped right on it. Mm. And of course, they had the good fortune of knowing exactly what was going to be successful and what wasn't going to be successful. Right. It was going to be a flop. And that's an interesting study in and of itself.
Mm-hmm. And just kind of put things kind of historically, you know, this is 1745 to 1820, which is right when here in the United States we were politically, there was so much upheaval and, of course, the revolution, and we were so focused on that. Yeah. And then the other side was that there was the Irish question, as always, the Catholic, Protestant, and those political mm-hmm. machinations that were going on. And so this is all happening for pleasure in the midst of all of this politics and...
Well, actually, to be honest about it, this is kind of a quiet time in Irish politics, mm-hmm. except right at the end of the 18th mm-hmm. century, mm-hmm. 1798 rebellion. And then in the early 18th century, there was the Robert Emmet rebellion, which disrupted theater performances and, the, you know, obviously the society of the day considerably. But from 1745, really until the 1780s, things were fairly quiet there. And this is one of the interesting things about the theater audience, because we really have very little evidence about who these people were. And one of the things I'm proudest of in this book, and that I spent an awful lot of time working on, was trying to get some sense of who these people were. Now, I could get little snippets from newspapers describing the names and so forth and get a sense. But the real issue, the one you raised a minute ago, was, you know, were these people Protestants who went along to these theaters sometimes in Dublin, or were they Catholics, or just what the heck was it? Mm-hmm. Because there's a huge nationalistic problem that has existed in Ireland for a long, long time. It's dissipating now, mm-hmm. but for a long time there was this sense that anything that had smacked of Britain was illegitimate, mm-hmm. and that the Irish should not somehow or another participate in it. Which is like saying, you know, Broadway shouldn't put on it Andrew Lloyd Webber or something like that. But in any event, the large numbers of what I was able to determine, I think, it's convincing to me and to people I've presented it at conferences, was that I took the population statistics for the city of Dublin, which we had, And they actually broke them down by religion and found out that roughly 1760, the preponderance of the population had become Catholic, whereas earlier it was Protestant. And then by the end of the century, the vast majority of the population was Catholic.
In Dublin.
Now, the point is, the theaters got bigger. And as the theaters got bigger, well, it took more and more people to fill them up. But there was no change in the Protestant numbers. So how did the theater survive? There was only one way. Significant numbers of Catholics going along to the plays. Let's see, I think my statistics, I hope, are right, but that's something I think is a fairly significant determiner. And it will work into people's, I think, reassessments of this whole nationalistic and the element and the importance of Irish drama, Irish theater as a part of the whole culture of Dublin at this mm-hmm. time, Protestant mm-hmm. and Catholic.
Yeah, not just the Anglo-Protestant element there.
Well, yes. I mean, that is the stereotype, isn't it, of Ireland at that mm-hmm. time.
I want to tell people who may just be tuning in, my guest is Professor John Green, a host of Night Train Jazz, also a professor of English here at UL Lafayette. His latest publication, Theater in Dublin, 1745 to 1820, History, Volumes 1 and 2, and then A Calendar of Performances, Volumes 1 through 6. The history is fascinating and bringing up so many issues. The calendar of performances, over 18,000 performances that you deal with in this calendar, essentially a daily calendar of what went on in the theaters in Dublin.
That's right.
That is massive amount of work.
Well, yeah.
And just kind of give us a list of everything that you cover. What kinds of details are you looking at daily?
Well, everything. Basically, what it is, I would say probably 75% of it is going through the newspaper. They had ads back then, the same as they do today. So I'd flip through the newspaper, I'd find the ad for the performance, and I'd transcribe it. And then I'd go on to the next day and transcribe it and so forth and so on all the way through. And then, as newspapers proliferated, and by the end of the By 1820, you're talking about 6 or 7 daily newspapers, morning and evening, and there were magazines and so forth. And that's why I was so lucky to get into the National Library and for them to allow me to look at these newspapers, because most people cannot look at them. This vast amount of material just accumulates, and some of it, you know, qualifies what other newspapers said. Some of it's inaccurate and all that. So, mm-hmm. And then, of course, there are all the memoirs of the actors and actresses, and the journal articles about them, and there had periodicals,
the
had loads mm-hmm. of magazines, mm-hmm. you know, that published reviews and so forth. And so I include all that stuff. And I didn't transcribe every review verbatim, but I did transcribe anything I thought might contribute to more than just somebody saying, well, I really liked the way Mrs. So-and-so acted mm-hmm. last night. Mm-hmm.
What I found this fascinating in the list that the publisher, again, it's Lehigh University Press, talks about how you're talking about the dancers, the mechanics, all of the different types of people who were working in the theater, not just the actors and actresses and the titles, but everything that went into creating a play in those days.
Yes. Well, there's that. There's certainly that. I just want to mention one thing. I think I was proud about the population mm-hmm. business, but one of the things I think I'm most proud of, and I had the help here of Lafayette artist Randall LeBray, if you know Randall, mm-hmm. a great guy. And one of the things that I was able to do, and we don't have time to discuss it at all, was to recreate a theater, probably the most famous theater in Ireland during this period. And we're able to do that almost by chance. A woman, that they were getting ready to tear this building down, which had been a church since the early 19th century. And they had to do this because these were, of course, valuable buildings and valuable historically. And they wanted to determine, assuming that it was built after 1800, they could tear it down and it could be put to other uses. And this was prime real estate. And I mean, they couldn't get more prime real estate in Dublin, right on the river. I mean, extraordinary. So she's in there, and she's pulling down the choir stall, and she looks at the wall, and she says, those bricks were 18th century bricks. These are not 19th century bricks. And so she had them strip all of the plaster off all the walls, and she discovered that over 80% of this building was the old Smock Alley Theater. So what she did then was she did drawings of the plugged-up windows and doors and so forth and so on. But most of that, of course, would appear to be a part of the church, the Catholic Church. But if you knew something about the theater, what we tried to do between us was look at the theater part of it and see what that theater looked like in the 18th century when it was in business. And Randall, in the first chapter of this book, has a wonderful 3 drawings, artist's
recreating
impressions of
mm-hmm,
what this mm-hmm. looked like. And
so the Smock Alley Theater.
The Smock Alley Theater, yeah.
One of the top theaters in Dublin then.
That was it for a long, long time.
Wow. You know, I was just thinking, you know, we often read novels, historical fiction novels, films that talk about how much research the author, the screenwriter did to be so accurate in the characters and the setting of the time period. And I'm just imagining this plethora of novels now about 18th century Irish theater that can come about because of the research that you've done.
Yes, people can do that, yeah.
But the way you've made these people come alive again with their names, what they did daily, what they did in the theater for decades in Dublin, Ireland. It's not, you know, and again, there is, I guess, again, for lay people outside of academic work, would think of this as dusty library work, but you're bringing it alive. You're bringing this back in into all of our consciousness that these people lived, they had lives, they had talent, and they had a great time.
Yeah. They're interesting people, too.
They're interesting people. And again, it's not something that we're going to just run down to the local bookstore and buy for ourselves.
Oh, please.
But please do all eight volumes.
Supplies are limited.
My guest, John Green, professor of English at UL, his latest publication, eight volumes of it, the first two, A Theater in Dublin, 1745 to 1820, A History, Volumes 1 and 2. And then the other volumes are a detailed look at the 18,000 performances that went on in Dublin in the Smock Alley Theater and other theaters in Dublin during this time period. What was the most fun you had doing this book?
Oh, gosh, I couldn't say. I guess traveling and going to the various libraries, particularly Dublin, the Dublin libraries. But I was able to go, you know, a lot of libraries in this country, and to Harvard and so forth. That was traveling generally to these places. And frankly, the most fun is just sitting in one of these dusty old places.
And discovering and, something.
Yeah, digging the British Library, the North Library, with the wind howling outside and the rain pattering on the windows, and you're sitting in there snug and warm with an old 18th century book.
You know, you could be inspiring a whole generation of young 18th century scholars here, John.
I hope so. If that's the sort of thing you like.
Well, it does sound like a lot of fun. Now, were you able to, I don't know, while you were doing this research, see any contemporary versions of some of these plays that you were writing about?
Well, yes. I mean, the ones that I would have seen were the ones that would be standard plays on the
Congreve.
Yeah, Congreve and so forth. I don't think offhand I can think of one even that was performed while I was there, but I wish it were.
What are some of your favorite plays from that time period?
My favorite play, I suppose, is Oliver Goldsmith's She Stoops to Conquer, which is pretty much a standard. I suppose my favorite plays are those. Some of them, it's very difficult to say because, for example, I talked about this Isaac Bickerstaff, who had extraordinary success on the London stage and the Irish stage, for that matter. But he, around 1660, thereabouts, drama started to take a change, and it started to become much more involved with music. And so instead of having farces, you'd have comic operas and so forth. Now, Bickerstaff wrote comic operas, obviously in conjunction with a composer, one or another composers. Unfortunately, a lot of the music has disappeared, and I don't myself play an instrument, and I'd love to, so I don't know what the music sounds like. And that's something I'd really like someday to if someone were willing to put the money into it, I suppose, is see a couple of those performed on the professional stage with music and so forth.
Well, perhaps this work will inspire that kind of musical recreation of it.
I would certainly hope so. It's that the whole point was to make the stuff available for people to carry on.
What year did She Stoops to Conquer come out?
1775.
All right, not long. How many times was it produced in Dublin? Do you know how many?
Oh gosh, I could tell you if I